A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking how all-you-can-eat buffets actually stay in business. The whole model seems like economic suicide on paper. Fixed price, variable consumption, and the customer's entire goal is to eat as much as possible while the restaurant's goal is to serve as little as possible. It's the only business I can think of where the two parties are playing completely opposite games, and somehow both walk away happy. He's also asking about unlimited breakfast deals and whether the common theory holds up, that light eaters subsidize the heavy ones. There's a lot to unpack here.
There is, and I love this question because it sits right at the intersection of behavioral economics, operational engineering, and pure kitchen math. On the surface, a buffet looks like a guaranteed loss. You hand someone a plate and say, go nuts for $15, and you're betting your entire margin on the hope that they won't actually do that.
Someone always knows someone who treats the buffet like a personal challenge. The guy who skips lunch, shows up hungry, and camps at the crab leg station for 2 hours. The existence of that guy makes the whole model feel fragile.
That guy is the reason people think they understand buffet economics, and he's also the reason most people get it wrong. There's a landmark study from 2016 by Brian Wansink and Colin Payne at Cornell's Food and Brand Lab. They analyzed 139 all-you-can-eat sushi restaurants. Actual real-world transaction and consumption data, not surveys. The average customer ate 3.2 plates. But here's the kicker. The top 10% of eaters, the supposed buffet killers, consumed only about 2.1 times the average. Not 5 times, not 10 times. Just over double.
2.1 times the average. So the guy you picture as a human vacuum cleaner is eating maybe 6 or 7 plates of sushi while the average person eats 3. That's not exactly a business model destroyer.
And when you dig into why, you hit the first major insight that most buffet coverage misses. There's a physical hard cap that no amount of competitive spirit can overcome. The human stomach holds about 1.5 to 2 liters of volume at maximum comfortable capacity. Past that, you're in pain. And the foods that make up most buffet offerings, starches, proteins, fried items, they're not exactly compact. 3 plates of general buffet food hits that volume ceiling for most people. The top 10% push it to the discomfort zone, but they're not shattering any physical limits.
The stomach is the ultimate portion control device. The restaurant outsources the hard work of stopping you to your own biology.
They do it without saying a word. That's what makes it elegant. But there's a second layer here that's even more interesting. The self-selection problem actually works in the buffet's favor, not against it.
Walk me through that. Because the intuitive fear is adverse selection. The hungriest people flock to the all-you-can-eat sign, and you get killed.
That's the intuitive fear, and it's wrong. The Cornell study found something counterintuitive. The people who self-select into buffets aren't primarily the competitive eaters. They're families with young children who eat very little but are charged a lower kids' price. They're elderly diners who physically can't consume large volumes. They're diet-conscious people who like the control and variety of a buffet. A small scoop of this, a taste of that, without committing to a full entree. These groups perceive enormous value in the buffet model, and they're the ones who fill the seats.
Because the buffet solves a different problem for them. It's not about maximizing calorie intake per dollar. It's about variety. Oh, feeding picky kids without ordering 4 separate meals, or avoiding the commitment anxiety of ordering one dish and hating it.
And the people who do show up with the intention of getting their money's worth typically fail for reasons that have nothing to do with willpower. There's a satiety curve. The first plate is genuinely wonderful, the second plate is good, by the third plate you're negotiating with yourself. Diminishing marginal utility of food kicks in hard. That third plate of lo mein is not bringing the same joy as the first, and your body knows it.
The first plate is a revelation. The second is a conversation. The third is a hostage situation.
That's the point where most people tap out. Not because they've hit the break-even calculation in their head, but because eating stops being pleasant. The buffet isn't winning by outsmarting your wallet. It's winning by outlasting your appetite.
We've established that the heavy eater subsidy theory doesn't really hold up. The distribution of consumption is much narrower than people assume. But that can't be the whole story. Even if no one eats you into bankruptcy, you still need to make the margins work.
This is where we shift from behavioral economics to operational engineering. And the first thing to understand is that buffets win on labor costs in a way that a la carte restaurants simply can't match. When a line cook is making omelets to order, each omelet requires individual attention. Crack the eggs, pour, monitor, fold, plate. Maybe 3 minutes of direct labor per omelet. In a buffet kitchen producing 500 identical portions of scrambled eggs, you're talking about one cook cracking 5 dozen eggs into a giant mixing bowl, another pouring them onto a flat-top griddle the size of a door, and a third scraping them into a chafing dish. The per-unit labor cost drops by roughly 60%.
You're not just saving on the cooking labor, you're eliminating the entire front-of-house timing problem. No tickets to manage, no coursing, no fire-to-order coordination between the kitchen and the floor.
No waitstaff taking individual orders, no coursing appetizers before entrees, no timing desserts. The server at a buffet is essentially a busser who refills drinks. You can run a buffet dining room with maybe a third of the staff of a comparable full-service restaurant. That labor savings alone can be the difference between a 10% margin and a 25% margin.
The food itself. You're buying in bulk. You're preparing in bulk. You're not throwing away the mise en place for dishes that nobody ordered tonight.
Which brings up an important point about waste. People assume buffets must hemorrhage money on uneaten food that gets tossed at the end of the night. And they do budget for waste. Typically, 10 to 15% of food cost is allocated to what gets thrown away. But here's what's clever. They track it. Modern buffets use waste tracking systems. If the steamed broccoli consistently comes back half full on the compost bin, the portion size on the line gets reduced. If the mac and cheese always runs out, they make more. It's a continuous optimization loop.
The buffet isn't a static gamble where you put out 100 items and hope for the best. It's an adaptive system that learns what people actually eat and adjusts.
This connects directly to the plate size finding that I think is one of the most elegant pieces of buffet science. There was a 2012 study by Wansink and Van Ittersom that tested plate sizes in a real buffet setting. They found that switching from a standard 10.5-inch plate to a 9-inch plate reduced total food consumption by 22%.
22%? Just from losing an inch and a half of plate diameter? That's wild!
The diners didn't notice. They didn't report feeling hungrier or less satisfied. The smaller plate creates an optical illusion. The same amount of food looks more abundant on a 9-inch plate than it does on a 10.5-inch plate. Your brain sees a full plate and registers abundance. Your stomach gets 22% less food, and the restaurant pockets the difference in food costs without anyone feeling shortchanged.
It's the portion control equivalent of those hotel hallway carpets with the busy patterns that hide stains. You don't notice the design choice, but it's doing real work.
And Buffett's deployed dozens of these invisible design choices. The high-cost items, the prime rib, the shrimp, the crab legs, are almost never at the front of the line. They're at the back, or they're placed behind an action station where a server portions them out.
Because you've already loaded up on mashed potatoes and mac and cheese by the time you get there.
Golden Corral is the classic case study here. They position their steak and shrimp stations at the farthest point from the entrance. By the time a customer reaches them, their plate is already 70% full of starches and vegetables. The expensive proteins end up being a small fraction of the total plate composition, even for customers who specifically came for the steak.
It's the grocery store milk strategy applied to prime rib. Put the thing everyone wants at the back so they have to walk past everything else.
It works for the same reason. But buffets have an additional tool that grocery stores don't. They can control the replenishment rate. Crab legs don't come out in a giant overflowing mountain. They come out in small batches. Maybe a dozen clusters at a time. They get scooped up quickly, and there's a 3 or 4 minute gap before the next batch arrives. That gap creates a subtle rationing effect. Customers who might have taken 3 clusters take 2 because they don't want to be the person who empties the tray, or they don't want to wait around.
The illusion of abundance combined with the reality of controlled scarcity. You see the crab legs on the line. You know they exist. You feel like you have access to unlimited crab legs. But the actual flow rate is managed.
If a customer really wants to camp out and wait for 5 batches of crab legs, they can. The buffet won't stop them. But most people won't do that. The social friction of hovering over a station, the time cost, the subtle embarrassment, it's a soft barrier that works remarkably well.
Let me try to synthesize this. The buffet model works on at least 3 distinct layers. Layer 1 is behavioral. Self-selection brings in light eaters, stomach capacity caps the heavy ones, and satiety makes everyone quit before they hit the break-even point. Layer 2 is operational. Batch cooking slashes labor costs, waste tracking eliminates inefficiency, and the whole staffing model is leaner than a full-service restaurant. Layer 3 is design. Plate size, food placement, and replenishment rate all nudge consumption downward without anyone feeling manipulated.
That's a clean framework, and it explains why the model works across very different price points. A $12 Chinese buffet and an $80 Vegas seafood buffet are using the same principles, just with different ingredient costs. The Vegas buffet can afford to put out king crab and prime rib because even at $80 a head, the average customer's consumption is bounded by the same stomach capacity limit.
Although the Vegas buffet has an additional profit lever that the suburban Golden Corral doesn't, it's attached to a casino.
Right. And this is worth examining because it reveals something about how the buffet model can function as a loss leader. Casinos don't necessarily need their buffets to be profitable as standalone restaurants. The Wynn Las Vegas buffet at $65 a person might break even or even lose a small amount on the food itself. But the average customer who comes for the buffet spends $120 at the slots. The buffet is customer acquisition. The gaming floor is the revenue engine.
It's the Costco rotisserie chicken of the hospitality world. You lose a little on the chicken, but you make it back on everything else the customer buys while they're in the building.
That cross-subsidy model works in other contexts too. Hotel breakfast buffets are the cleanest example. A mid-tier hotel might charge $18 for the breakfast buffet. The food cost on that breakfast, scrambled eggs, bacon, pastries, cereal, coffee, runs about 15 to 20%. So the hotel's cost is maybe $3 to $4 per guest. The average guest who eats breakfast at the hotel would have spent maybe $14 ordering a la carte. The hotel makes an extra $4 per head, and the guest feels like they got a deal because, hey, unlimited bacon.
This brings us to the second part of the prompt, the unlimited breakfast deal. I want to dig into why breakfast specifically is such a profit machine for the buffet model.
Breakfast is almost unfair. The food costs are so low that the break-even point is practically unreachable. Let's take Denny's $6 unlimited pancakes as the example. A single pancake costs about 12 cents to produce. Flour, water, a little oil, maybe some egg powder, a splash of buttermilk flavoring. To eat 50 pancakes, you need to consume roughly 6,000 calories of pure starch. Your stomach would physically reject that volume long before you cost Denny's $6.
I don't think I could eat 50 pancakes if you gave me a week.
That's the point. The unlimited promise is a marketing construct, not a real cost exposure. The restaurant knows with mathematical certainty that the number of customers who can eat enough pancakes to erase the margin rounds to zero. But the word unlimited on the menu drives traffic. People who would never order pancakes a la carte because they're boring, or because they only want two, suddenly think, well, for $6 I can have as many as I want, and that feels like a win.
Even if they eat exactly 2 pancakes, which is what they would have eaten anyway.
Those 2 pancakes cost the restaurant 24 cents. The remaining $5.76 is pure contribution margin, minus a tiny bit for the server's time and the plate.
What about the other breakfast items? Eggs, bacon, sausage. Those have to cost more than pancake batter.
They do, but not as much as people assume. Eggs are roughly 15 to 18% food cost at current commodity prices. Bacon is higher, maybe 30 to 35%, which is why you'll notice that bacon at breakfast buffets is often cooked very crispy and served in smaller portions. Crispy bacon takes up less volume on the plate, and the texture encourages slower eating. Sausage links are cheaper than bacon and tend to be more prominently displayed.
The crispy bacon detail is exactly the kind of thing I love about this topic. Someone in a corporate test kitchen figured out that if you cook the bacon an extra 2 minutes, people take fewer strips and eat them more slowly, and that tiny delta multiplied across thousands of locations adds up to real money.
The entire buffet is a collection of those micro-optimizations. And breakfast has one more advantage that dinner buffets don't, the time constraint. Breakfast is typically a 2-hour window, maybe 6 to 10 in the morning. But the average guest spends about 22 minutes actually eating breakfast. They're not camping out for 3 hours like they might at a Sunday brunch. They've got meetings, or they're heading to the airport, or they want to get to the theme park. The clock is a natural consumption limiter that costs the restaurant nothing.
Plus, there's the beverage situation. Coffee and orange juice feel like high-value items, but the actual cost is negligible.
3 glasses of orange juice at a restaurant might cost you $12 a la carte. At a breakfast buffet, you can drink as much as you want and feel like a genius. The restaurant's cost on those 3 glasses is maybe 30 cents for the juice concentrate and water. The perceived value gap is enormous. The customer feels like they're extracting surplus, and the restaurant's margin barely budges.
The unlimited breakfast deal is basically the perfect buffet product. Food costs are rock bottom. The time window is naturally constrained. The beverage trap creates a false sense of victory. And the heaviest possible consumption still doesn't threaten the margin. It's almost elegant.
It explains why you're seeing chains expand these offerings even as food costs rise elsewhere. The math is just too good. Now, there's an important caveat I should mention about all of this. The Cornell study I cited earlier, Brian Wansink, the lead researcher, he's had some of his work retracted in subsequent years due to data irregularities in unrelated studies. The buffet research specifically hasn't been challenged, and the findings are consistent with what industry operators report, but full transparency, the academic record there has some asterisks.
That's a fair flag. But the operational data from the industry itself, the food cost percentages, the labor differentials, the waste tracking numbers, those come from restaurant trade publications and industry analysts, not from any single academic paper.
And the plate size finding has been replicated in multiple contexts. Smaller plates lead to less consumption. That's pretty settled at this point. The exact percentage varies by study, but the direction and the mechanism are consistent.
Let's pull back and ask the bigger question. What does the buffet model teach us about the psychology of unlimited pricing more broadly?
This is where it gets interesting beyond restaurants. The buffet is the physical world analog of a subscription business model. You pay a fixed price for unlimited access. The business bets that your actual usage will be lower than your perceived usage at the point of purchase. And that gap between how much you think you'll consume and how much you actually consume is where the profit lives.
Gym memberships are the classic example. You sign up in January thinking you'll go 4 times a week. By March, you're going 2x a month. The gym's business model doesn't require you to stop going entirely. It just requires you to go less than you imagined you would.
Streaming services, unlimited cloud storage, all-you-can-eat data plans. The same dynamic. The word unlimited triggers a value calculation in the consumer's mind that almost always overestimates actual usage. And the business doesn't need to trick anyone. It just needs to correctly price the average actual usage, not the aspirational usage.
The buffet adds a physical dimension that purely digital subscriptions don't have. Your stomach is the ultimate usage meter. You can't binge a buffet the way you can binge a Netflix series. The physical constraint is absolute.
Which is why buffet-style models in the physical world are so robust. They don't rely on customer forgetfulness or inertia the way gym memberships do. They rely on biology. And biology is much more predictable than human willpower.
If you're an entrepreneur thinking about launching a buffet or a buffet-adjacent business, what are the non-negotiable design principles?
4 things, based on everything we've discussed. First, keep your overall food costs below 30% of the price point. If you're charging $20, your average plate cost needs to be under $6. Second, control the plate size. 9 inches, not 10.5. This single decision is worth a 20% reduction in food cost. Third, position your high-cost items at the back of the line and use batch replenishment to create natural scarcity. Never put the crab legs at the start of the buffet. Fourth, target a diverse customer base. You want families with small children, elderly diners, tourists who eat at odd hours. A homogeneous customer base of hungry 25-year-old men is a fast path to bankruptcy.
That last point is underrated. The diversity of the customer base is a natural hedge. The buffet doesn't need every customer to be a light eater. It just needs the distribution to be wide enough that the average stays manageable.
Most buffets achieve that naturally through location and pricing. A buffet in a shopping mall food court draws families. A buffet near a retirement community draws seniors. A buffet at a highway rest stop draws a mix of travelers with varying appetites and time constraints. The customer mix is part of the business model, even if the owner never articulates it that way.
What about the consumer side? If someone wants to actually get their money's worth at a buffet, not in a destructive, eat-till-you're-sick way, but strategically, what's the playbook?
Skip the starches entirely. No rice, no pasta, no bread, no potatoes. Those are the highest margin items for the restaurant and the lowest value for you. Go straight for protein. The food cost on meat is 3 to 5 times higher than on carbs. Start with the most expensive protein on the line and build your plate around it. Crab legs, prime rib, salmon, shrimp, in that order.
Avoid the salad bar as a first stop. That's filler.
Salad is water and fiber. It takes up stomach volume and delivers almost no caloric or monetary value relative to the price of admission. Eat your salad at home. At the buffet, you're on a protein mission.
Even with optimal strategy, you're probably not going to bankrupt the restaurant.
You're not. The house always wins. And that's not because the house is cheating. It's because the house designed the game, and the game was designed around average human behavior, which is remarkably consistent. The buffet doesn't need to beat every customer. It just needs to beat the average. And the average, as we've seen, leaves money on the table.
Here's a question I haven't seen addressed much. As food costs rise, beef prices are up, eggs have been volatile, dairy keeps climbing. Does the buffet model start to crack?
It's under pressure, and we're already seeing adaptations. Some chains are moving to limited refill models instead of true all-you-can-eat. You get 2 plates for 1 price, and a 3rd plate costs extra. Others are introducing dynamic pricing. Weekday lunch is cheaper than weekend dinner, which aligns the price more closely with the expected consumption patterns. The heavy eaters tend to come on weekends, so charging more on weekends is a way of pricing in the adverse selection.
The premium buffet segment. The $80 seafood spreads. Those have more margin to absorb food cost increases. If your food cost goes from 30% to 35% on an $80 ticket, you're still making money. The $15 buffet has much less room to maneuver.
The $15 buffet is the one that's threatened, and we might see a bifurcation where the low-end buffets either disappear or switch to cafeteria-style pricing by weight, while the high-end buffets thrive as experiential dining. The Vegas model, treating the buffet as a destination experience rather than a value play, that seems durable.
There's also the technology angle. Automated cafeterias, smart buffets with portion-controlled dispensers, AI systems that predict demand and adjust cooking volumes in real time. Does that change the equation?
It eliminates the remaining labor cost. If you can run a buffet with no line cooks, no servers, just a couple of attendants to keep things clean and refill ingredients, your labor percentage drops from maybe 25% to under 10%. That's enormous. The question is whether customers will accept it. There's something fundamentally human about the buffet experience. The abundance, the choice, the slight chaos of elbowing past someone to get the last egg roll. A robot-served buffet might feel too sterile.
The chaos is part of the value proposition. You're not just buying food. You're buying the experience of abundance. The slightly guilty pleasure of going back for a 4th plate even though you're full. The automated version might deliver the food but miss the feeling.
The feeling is what sells the unlimited promise in the first place. The buffet works because it feels like a loophole in the normal rules of commerce. You pay once, and then everything is free. That emotional experience is worth more than the actual food cost savings to a lot of customers.
The loophole feeling. That's exactly it. You walk in, you see the spread, and some ancient part of your brain says, "I have hacked the system." The restaurant is counting on that feeling lasting exactly long enough for you to pay and sit down. After that, biology takes over.
The restaurant has done the math on exactly when biology will win.
The next time you see an all-you-can-eat sign, remember, you're not competing with the restaurant. You're competing with your own stomach. And the restaurant has been studying your stomach a lot longer than you have.
That's the mic drop version. And it's true. The buffet is a masterclass in understanding human limits and designing a business around them. It's not a gamble. It's not a loss leader in most cases. It's a carefully engineered system that converts the gap between perceived appetite and actual appetite into profit.
The unlimited breakfast deal is the same system on easy mode. Lower food costs, tighter time constraints, and a beverage trap that makes you feel like a winner while you drink 30 cents worth of orange juice.
The beverage trap alone deserves its own episode. But for now, I think we've answered the core question. Buffets make money because the average customer's stomach quits before the restaurant's margin does. The heavy eater subsidy theory is mostly wrong. The distribution of consumption is narrow, self-selection favors the restaurant, and operational efficiencies do the rest of the work.
If you want to beat the buffet, your only real move is to skip the starches, target the proteins, and accept that even with optimal play, you're probably not going to break the bank. The house always wins, but you can at least make them earn it. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1810s, French naturalist René Caillier observed fungal mycelial networks spanning an estimated 240 hectares in what is now Chad, roughly the area of 440 football fields, or about two-thirds the size of Central Park.
Right.
That's a lot of underground fungus.
Two-thirds of Central Park. I'll be thinking about that next time I'm in Central Park, which is never.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, share it with someone who always tries to get their money's worth at the buffet. They'll either learn something or feel deeply seen.
I'm Corn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.